This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
2 years ago this weekend, Russia invaded neighbouring Ukraine, clearly anticipating a quick victory. Instead, it got a bloody attritional war in which tens of thousands of its soldiers have died, and it has faced unprecedented sanctions from the countries of the West. Last week, almost as if to mark the approaching anniversary, Russia's leading dissident, Alexei Navalny, died suddenly in a remote labour camp. So what? 2 years on is the state of Russia, and what is the state of the opposition to Vladimir Putin? To what extent are the sanctions working, and how tight is Putin's grip on power? Step inside the briefing room, and together we'll find out. First, I want to understand what the death of Alexei Navalny means for the opposition in Russia. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford reported from Russia for more than 20 years before being expelled from the country in 2021. She's now the BBC's Eastern Europe correspondent and is speaking from Poland. Sarah Rainsford, how popular was Alexei Navalny in Russia?
Well, in a completely controlled political system, it's impossible to be sure. The only real measure we had of that, I guess, was back in 2013 when he ran for mayor. At the time, he'd just been convicted in a Russian court of embezzlement, but a prosecutor intervened and allowed him out to run for election. And he almost forced the vote to a runoff, to a second round. He got 27% of the support in Moscow. The only other kind of visual measure of that is how many people he could bring out onto the streets in protest. And it's definitely true to say he was the one man and his organisation was the one organisation that could really bring out substantial crowds.
Essentially, that was repressed, wasn't it, by firstly his imprisonment, then he was taken abroad after the poisoning, went abroad after the poisoning, and then voluntarily came back and then was imprisoned again and has now died. How much influence during that period when he was behind bars was he able to have?
It was extraordinary that he managed to continue to communicate even behind bars. I think the horror at his poisoning in 2020, the fact that he very, very nearly died, and then he chose to come back to Russia, gave him this kind of aura, I suppose. And so I think his support probably increased. And then he managed from behind bars to keep on addressing the Russian people. So he would not only appear in court by video link from prison, because there were multiple additional criminal charges brought over his time in prison, so more and more charges in order to keep him behind bars. He would also bring formal complaints himself against the prison system so that he would appear in court and then could address people. And he would also manage to get statements out via his lawyers. He would manage to get them published on social media. He would manage to continue to communicate in quite unbelievable ways. How much support that had? Well, his organization was banned as extremist. Many of his allies were sent to prison for very long prison terms themselves. And most of his organization is now in exile because they physically had to flee Russia for their own safety.
But nonetheless, he would have been seen as a thorn in the side of the Russian establishment right up until the point of his death.
I think the very fact that he continued to get any word out to the Russian people would have annoyed the Kremlin, definitely. And I think the fact that he remained cheerfully defiant would have really annoyed the Kremlin, because not only was he continuing to call people to change Russia for the better, he was also doing that with this bizarre positive attitude. He was laughing in court. He was cheerful. He was refusing to be broken. And it was very, very visible because he had those video appearances in court.
Many people will have been hoping that his death would lead to a substantial popular movement against Vladimir Putin within Russia. Are there any signs of that happening realistically?
No, I think there is a climate of fear. People are afraid of coming out. They are afraid of being arrested. They're afraid of being beaten up. The criminal charges that are now used against protesters and against all political opposition in Russia have become more extreme. You can actually go to prison for a much longer time. So I think people are very, very wary of actually coming out onto the streets. And that is because, as well, Navalny's organization was declared extremist, and supporting an extremist organization has massive criminal consequences for people in terms of punishment. And so when Navalny died, what we saw was this quiet gesture of protest, people bringing flowers to monuments, to political prisoners, to political repression. But there was no outpouring of anger or fury. There hasn't been yet. And I think it's quite unlikely because so many people are afraid.
There's another Russian presidential election next month, and Vladimir Putin is standing, I think, for the fifth term. Who else is on the ballot?
There are three candidates, but in a way they don't really matter because it's a reappointment. It's not an election. And in fact, all of the candidates who are standing, none of them have criticised Putin openly, and they've all said in one way or another that they don't actually expect to win the election.
This is actually just really a sham of an election, isn't it? Which is designed to show you're having one, but it doesn't actually have the reality of an election.
Certainly a sham election, and it's about Vladimir Putin giving himself a veneer of legitimacy. But there is no real challenger who will get anywhere near running for election. There was one person who spoke out against the war, who tried to run for president. His name was Boris Nadezhdin. He was banned in the end from running. I suppose for the opposition, the one positive thing to come of that was the sight of long queues of people lining up to register their support for Nadezhdin as a candidate. He needed to gather 100,000 signatures. And there were big queues across the country. And I think probably at that point, the Kremlin realised that there was no way they could allow him to be registered because he may get too much support. And therefore, that might become the story rather than Vladimir Putin's glorious re-election with at least 80% of the vote.
Yeah, so nyet to Nadezhdin.
Totally nyet.
Sarah Rainsford. Critical to the Russian nobility and its people's willingness to sustain the war was supposed to be what happened to the country's economy. So what has happened to it? And what's been the impact of sanctions? Maria Shaginer is Research Fellow for Economic Sanctions, Standards and Strategy at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in Berlin. Maria Shaginer, can you remind us of the scope and the extent of the sanctions against Russia that were imposed after it invaded Ukraine 2 years ago?
The scope and extent of sanctions have been rather unprecedented. We've seen a plethora of sanctions types imposed on Russia. In fact, more than 16,000 designations have been imposed on Russia, more than on North Korea, Iran, and Syria combined. Individual sanctions, Vladimir Putin is there on the list. Financial sanctions, more than 70% of Russia's financial system is now under sanctions. The reserves from the central bank have been frozen, which is, again, unprecedented, was never done against a G20 economy. And the impact, the expectations of the impact didn't match the reality, right? The forecast was that the Russian economy would, if not collapse, but would reduce by 15%, by 20%. Those were the wild forecasts that we've seen in March 2022. That didn't come to reality. Russia has withstand pressure from sanctions, and this is the main goal for this year, how to make sure that the funds that are going towards Russia are not as big as used to be.
Okay, so This is a very good point at which to ask you to explain why you think that those predictions have not come true. In other words, how Russia has adapted its economy to meet the challenges of the sanctions. What has it actually done and how's it worked?
On the one hand, Russia has been preparing for this. It has a playbook since 2014 how to react to certain type of sanctions, in particular in the financial sector, switched away from the US dollar to other currencies. It has created alternative financial messaging system, an alternative to Visa and MasterCard. So it has been doing homework. It has also deployed its quite skillful technocrats at the central banks, the Central Bank of Russia, and they were quite swift to react to the measures. We've seen interest rates were hiked to 20% to prevent capital outflow. And Russia has also engaged its former satellites that used to have relations with in the Middle East, in Latin America, to establish new supply chains, to basically create parallel supply chains of goods that were not coming from the West anymore.
Which are now its biggest trading partners?
Now China is the biggest trading partner of Russia. Russia has been pledging to pivot to Asia, in particular to China, since 2012, but it never delivered on this promise. Now, as we've seen that the West has closed its door to Russia, Russia doesn't have any other game to play, and it has to pivot to China.
Can we look at the budgetary aspects of this? Because proceeding with a war for 2 years must be incredibly expensive, and it's not hugely productive. And yet there is something called a war economy that has its own kind of dynamic. Can you take us through how Russia has managed its war economy and its expenditure?
Indeed, Russia's economy is now on war footing, and this is the entire source of GDP growth. Despite this macroeconomic stability that is widely praised by the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, that is a shaky fundamentals, right? We've seen more than $100 billion that are allocated for defense and national security spending for this year. It's more than 68% versus last year. So war is really on the mind of the Russian elites. There is no doubt that they will allocate every ruble towards the war effort, but it's not the source of innovation and technological progress. The problems for Russia will be how to convert its militarized economy to the civil one once the war is over.
Is there any sense that ordinary people are actually in any way feeling the consequences of the war in any significant fashion?
Yes and no. If we zoom in on Moscow and St. Petersburg, large cities, the life is as it was. Perhaps international brands left the country, and that was the main unexpected outcome of this sanctions warfare. But now there is new business opportunities for people to bring these items through parallel imports or via third countries. So in these bigger towns, life hasn't changed much, apart from high inflation we talked about. On the periphery, there are also new beneficiaries. Yes, maybe the government doesn't have money to allocate to the peripheral towns anymore, but on the same time, those are the people who are joining the war, meaning they get much higher wages, sometimes 3 times higher than the average wage, and that creates incentive for them to join. There are also programs to subsidize mortgages. So there is a property boom in Russia for the time being. And this is the opportunity for people from poorer cities to actually tap into this market. So short term, we can see the picture is mixed, but long term, it will be quite gloomy.
Maria Shagina. A big part of Russia's economy is oil. With me is Isaac Levi, who analyses flows of Russian oil at the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air. Isaac Levi, how many barrels of oil does Russia produce a day now, and how does that compare to before the war?
So in 2023, Russia was exporting 7 million barrels of oil per day. We've seen them maintain relatively stable volumes of oil exports per day, but they've had to find new buyers of their oil, which used to previously get sold to the UK, EU and G7 countries. Now they're selling over 70% of their oil to India and China. In order to find new willing buyers of their oil, they've have to offer discounts in the price that they export the oil at to encourage these new sales.
So essentially, is it about the same level of oil that they're selling in value terms as they were before the war? It's just to different people?
We've seen around a 20% drop in the oil export revenues in the second year of the invasion. However, there has been an increase originally in the first year as oil prices spiked and the Western countries hadn't sanctioned or banned the importation of Russian oil.
Why have the amounts to these other countries, India and China and so on, increased by so much? What are they doing with it?
So India, who've propped up as a new buyer of the oil, have increased their imports of Russian crude oil from around 13 times from the year before the invasion to the second year. So they really didn't used to buy a lot of this stuff.
13 times?
Yes, exactly. So they're now the biggest seaborne importer of Russian crude oil. And a lot of it is for domestic consumption. They refine this crude oil from Russia into oil products such as diesel, jet fuel, other petroleum products that they consume domestically. But we've also seen an increase in imports into India from Russia, that they've refined this oil into oil products that we talked about, such as jet fuel, diesel products, that then get sold to the UK, EU and West.
So we are buying Russian oil as bought and refined by India. Do we have any idea how much comes to the UK?
Yes, our report stated that since the implementation of the ban on Russian crude oil on the 5th of December 2022, the UK imported 660 million euros of oil products that's estimated as coming from Russian crude.
So that's an indirect way in which we are consuming Russian oil. Are there more direct ways? I mean, are there other ways in which somehow the system is being gamed?
One of the other ways we've seen perhaps oil products coming into the UK is through what we're seeing is ship-to-ship transfers taking place of two tankers lining up next to each other in areas such as the Greek coast, transferring the oil maybe several times and mixing Russian oil with non-Russian oil to obfuscate or mask the origin of what this oil is, and then selling it into countries that might be imposing sanctions, such as the UK.
So let me get this straight. It's a Russian tanker originally, as it say, coming out of a Russian port. And I'm presuming that previously the carrier of that oil, Russian oil, would have not been a Russian tanker.
So before the war, we were seeing about 90% of all Russian oil that was sold and transported on tankers being transported on UK, US or EU insured tankers. Since the war, Russia's tried to replace that with tankers owned or insured in India, China, other countries, Russia itself, that are outside of those that impose sanctions.
So one of these tankers leaves a Russian port full of Russian oil, meets up with other tankers off the Greek coast, and it gets transferred and therefore maybe mixed with other oil. And then what? Maybe comes straight back to the UK?
Well, there are enforcement agencies that should be monitoring this and preventing that from happening, because that would be an illegal violation of the sanctions. However, some tankers we're seeing as mixing two or three different batches of oil. So they might take some from Russia, some from Saudi Arabia, and they might do these mixings several times. Therefore, when those shipments come into the UK or other countries such as the EU, it's very hard to tell what the origin of the oil is. And it's a way of increasing Russia's sales of oil.
Right. And the net result of all this is that Russia's oil revenue has not dropped anything like as far as people in the West were hoping and predicting.
That is correct.
Isaac Levi, if we take all this into account, where does it leave Vladimir Putin himself and his purchase on power? Joining me now is Mark Galeotti, a writer on Russian security affairs and director of the consultancy Mayak Intelligence. Mark Galeotti, in terms of public support in Russia, how much of a win is it for Putin that the economy actually hasn't tanked?
Well, we should recognise that although the economy sounds as if it's doing quite well, if you disaggregate the civil sector from the military sector, I mean, times are hard. So yes, it's good for Putin that the economy hasn't been destroyed by sanctions, but that was never really likely. Instead, though, what we are seeing already is a slow grinding down of life as experienced by most Russians. In order to keep the economy going for the military, he's had to raid investment for the civilian sector, investment in infrastructure, spending on health, spending on social provisions, all these kind of things. And this is why ordinary Russians are feeling their life getting slowly, but nonetheless appreciably worse. So yes, in the short term and in terms of supporting the battlefield, the economy is doing okay. But there are worrying signs for the long term as regards ordinary Russians' experiences.
The other thing I was wondering about ordinary Russians' experiences and Russian public opinion was to wonder whether it actually matters what it is.
It does matter. I mean, I think this is one of the misunderstandings often of authoritarian regimes. And definitely we have to recognize that Putin's regime has really sort of devolved into its banana republic stage. But the point is, you still have to worry about not provoking the public too far. We've already seen that. For example, there are generals who want Putin to launch a new mobilization wave to recruit another hundreds of thousands of additional Russians for the front line in Ukraine. Putin so far has been very reluctant to do that, not for any humanitarian reasons, but because he has presidential elections coming up and he knows just how disruptive and unpopular the first mobilization wave was. So it does act as a constraint on the Kremlin. And in the final analysis, it's precisely the threat of some kind of wider public insurrection which is going to condition how the elite regard their own risk-benefit analysis.
Well, let's talk about that elite now. Who does he have to worry about? Can we get inside that group?
Well, in some ways, who he has to worry about are not the people at the very top of the system so much as their chains of command. We saw this last year when the entrepreneur-turned-mercenary captain, Yevgeny Prigozhin, launched his now infamous mutiny. And at a time when we had forces marching towards Moscow, what we saw was the head of the National Guard, the main internal security agency, burning up the phones, trying to get his local commanders to do something to try and stop this march. And his local commanders, by all accounts, were in the main trying desperately to avoid being contacted. They didn't want to receive orders that they would either have to execute or openly reject. So I suspect there was a lot of people who had lost their phones or happened to be out of range or something. This is the point. If the chain of command begins to get attenuated, then even if you control the commander-in-chief of the military and the head of the internal security services and so forth, they just become a bunch of old men with phones that nobody wants to answer. So I think the real issue is about, say, within the elite as a whole. I know I'm sidestepping your question in a way, but rather than pointing to any individual figure, what we've seen when this kind of regime collapses, and we've got the example, after all the Warsaw Pact countries, even before the Soviet Union went, it's more that you might say when the machinery starts to refuse to follow orders, then actually the guys at the top generally have to follow suit.
And that's really fascinating, particularly the idea that actually a lot of people in significant positions will suddenly stop and you'll find that your levers aren't connected to anything. But you still needed a Prigozhin to launch that in the first place in order to get to that situation. So I suppose I'm partially wondering if there are other Prigozhins around who would act as the catalyst for such a moment.
I mean, that there are figures we could point to, you know, ranging from sort of regional warlords like Chechnya's Ramzan Kadyrov to other figures within the administration. But I think it's more of a systemic issue. I mean, what we've seen, and this is why, although I would dearly love to, I can't suggest that Putin's regime is about to collapse next Wednesday or whatever. It's because the system is still very strong in handling the day-to-day challenges of the war and domestic management. What it's losing is its capacity to respond to crises. And although it's always very difficult to know quite which black swan will flutter over the Kremlin next, one thing we do know about politics is there will always be some crisis in the future. So it could be a collapse of the front lines in Ukraine. It could be a rolling economic crisis that hits in one Russian region and then spreads to the next. It could be Putin falling sick or whatever. But the point is, when there is a crisis, then actually, and it could well be not to do with any individual, but to do with these sort of wider forces, that's when I think the Kremlin is forced into a tough situation and the elite are forced to make decisions about what to do and who to follow.
That's very interesting, because one model for looking at authoritarian rule, which we tend to have in the West, and I think Donald Trump expresses it very well, is that there is a kind of cleverness to authoritarianism, and that actually somebody like Putin is rather ingenious in how he goes about things. The picture you're depicting is that authoritarianism actually tends to come at the price of a capacity to innovate or to respond properly to events.
I think particularly when the authoritarian has been in power so long. I mean, he's now entering his 24th year of direct and indirect rule over Russia. And in that process, Putin, like so many autocrats before him, is in effect becoming something of a caricature of himself, surrounding himself more and more with an echo chamber of cronies and yes men, being more and more separate and detached from his own people and his own country. And this is the problem we've actually seen. I mean, ranging from the very decision to invade in the first place, where he seemed to have convinced himself that the Ukrainians, remember, this is a man who, as he made pretty clear to Tucker Carlson recently, does not really believe that Ukraine is a country. And he thought that they would just simply roll over. Even though there are many people within his system who knew better, but clearly no one could or dared try and tell him otherwise. Even now, if one looks at the conduct of the war and the civilian economy, this is a man who, you know, I don't want to say that he has no skills and talents, but this is not the man, the lean young newcomer of the year 2000, who was still working out how to rebuild his country. This is a man who's got comfortable and complacent and old, and in that process, absolutely doesn't seem to have much flexibility, much ability to actually learn from his previous mistakes.
A rather large number of his political rivals have died in what I think people call unfortunate circumstances. And I'm not trying to make light of that at all. It's obviously pretty hideous. But my question to you is that a sign of strength, or should we rather interpret it as a sign of weakness?
I mean, I think it's a sign of weakness as well as the evolution or degeneration of Putin's regime. Back in the day, certainly in his early terms, Putin was even then clearly an authoritarian who created basically a stage-managed fake democratic system to conceal that. But the point is, he didn't, on the whole, have to kill people. Yes, there were individuals who died, but basically speaking, he could rely on spin, on intimidation, and on a considerable degree of genuine legitimacy in the country. Now, I think that is all decaying. And I think precisely the increased use of authoritarianism, the increased brutality, all of this to me suggests a system that is weakened, in fact. And although people are not necessarily moving against it, that is because in some ways they are feeling like the hostages of a man with low impulse control and a loaded gun, rather than because they are delighted to be following him.
He's not a spring chicken, he's 71, can't be there forever. What happens when he's gone?
I think that what we're going to see, assuming he hasn't managed any kind of succession himself, and at the moment he's giving no signs of thinking in those terms, but I think what happens, just as what happened when Stalin died, is we will see the not so great and not so good of the system, individuals, factions and institutions jockeying behind the scenes to succeed him. And the point is, there is no one person who has the personal authority and power base to be able to step up there. So almost invariably, what happens will be the result of some kind of coalition politics. And that is a good thing, because it tends to drag politics away from the extremes. But also, it will be a generational change. So, you know, it's likely to shift to a new generation who are, to be blunt, on the whole, ruthless, pragmatic kleptocrats. They're not driven by any sort of grand vision of making Russia great again, so much as actually just simply power and money and the capacity to steal with impunity. So I think it will mean a distinct change. And I think it'll be the result of internal struggles within the elite that are probably unlikely to actually come much into the open. We'll just one day we'll hear that Putin is dead, or probably had died a couple of days before, and that whoever it is seems to be the new crown prince and successor.
Mark Galeotti with the last word there. My thanks to him, Sarah Rainsford, Isaac Levi and Maria Shaginer. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Nick Holland, Kirsty Knight and Ben Carter. The editor was Richard Barden, and the programme was mixed by Neil Churchill. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hold up.
Hi, I'm Mariana Spring, the BBC's disinformation and social media correspondent, and I've learned firsthand that the online world can be a breeding ground for hate. But why do some people behave the way they do on social media? For BBC Radio 4, I'm meeting the people at the heart of some extraordinary online conflicts to see if understanding, even forgiveness, is ever possible. Listen to Why Do You Hate Me on BBC Sounds.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Welt, in der sich Technologie und künstliche Intelligenz weiterentwickeln, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um Ihre Daten und Netzwerke vor Cyberrisiken zu schützen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.